Okay, diving back in here on Friday, October 30th, 2020. I'm Stephanie Valance, and I'm here with Jamie Partridge on Zoom again from both of our respective homes. And we are going to go back over a little chronologically, take a few steps back, I hear. Is that right, Jamie?
Yeah, I actually just wanted to do kind of an overview of my involvement in electoral politics, which I've been talking about quite a bit with the Rainbow Coalition, which is kind of the most concentrated piece of my electoral work, but prior and after, just to give a sense of my evolution around electoral politics, if that's okay. Yeah, history, right?
Yeah.
Change. So all these Rainbow News issues include candidate articles about candidates, candidate endorsements, and I worked on a lot of these campaigns. And I mentioned that I was a campaign manager for Jerry Washington's school board campaign. And of course, prior to that, I got my feet wet when I was a preteen, when my mother would send me around the neighborhood as she was a precinct committee person and, you know, delivering the Democratic Party flyers. But it really wasn't until the Jesse Jackson campaign and then the Rainbow Coalition that I really got deep into electoral candidate campaigns. And I remember that a really wonderful piece of our attitude as the Rainbow Coalition in vetting candidates and deciding who to support was, what was their track record, their credibility with community organizing or labor organizing, and how would their candidacy and their being in office build the movement, build community power or labor power? And I know that, you know, that this has been a common theme in my thinking about electoral work. And currently I'm in the my current iteration of my home base is the Democratic Socialists of America, and our way of talking about candidates and supporting candidates is, are they class struggle candidates? That is, do they identify the enemy as not just their opponent, you know, in the ballot, but the billionaire class? You know, and they're the candidate of the working class, and are they? I remember just being so struck by Jesse Jackson. I remember saying to people that he spent more time on strike picket lines than most labor leaders did. You know, and that was true of Bernie Sanders. He was a class struggle candidate in that he not only, you know, showed up for the photo ops, but he actually turned over his lists of contacts to labor unions to turn out community support for labor struggles. I mean, he actually used the resources that he had developed in his campaigns to support the movement. And the hardest piece, of course, is how do you keep that going once someone gets elected? And it's really hard. It really depends a lot on whether the person is grounded, you know, with not just years, but decades of involvement in the movements before they get into elected office, and which means that they have relationships, you know, deep relationships where when they go off track, you can pull their chain. You know, once you're in office, there are just so many pressures to follow the rules, you know, and to do, the civil and the negotiating, the behind closed doors, you know, trading votes and all that kind of crap. And of course, there's all the business lobbyists that are putting pressure on, you know, well, we're going to take our business out of town, or we're going to cut a bunch of jobs if you don't do what we say. And I know that currently I think of Joanne Hardesty as one of those people who's on our city council, who I was part of several of her electoral efforts, and just she is so grounded in decades of the struggle that she seems to be very little. I mean, she does do some vote trading and she does do some, political capital kinds of stuff, but she's very, very influenced by the movement. And when she talked most recently, when all these changes have happened to the police department that she's been struggling with for decades. And actually, when we get back to the Rainbow News, 1999, same stuff. Decades, right? And they've actually moved, in the last year. And she just totally, she says it's because of the people in the streets. It's because of these days and days and days of pressure that we've been able to move this stuff in the halls of the city hall. But anyway, just to say that even though that's the ideal, that I remember what happened with, I was going to say the, what happened with Jerry Washington was that we got her elected to school board, but then we kind of abandoned her and we we weren't there. I mean, the best, I'm thinking of the new party in places where the new party was more solid than we were in Portland. She would have people on, she would have a staff or at least a group of volunteers, who could be her her core committee, who could do the kind of research and development of policy and development of relationships with community groups and all that. And so the kind of support that she needed and kind of was left out there in the wilderness. And, what's the point in even electing people if you don't provide the kind of support that's needed to move the policy changes that you want?
Why was she abandoned, or why did you, that group?
Well, I just think that we're an all-volunteer organization. We weren't focused enough on, we just went on to the next struggle, right? And
And what was the outcome of that?
Well, that she wasn't able to move much change with her years on the board. And I mean, she was able to do some things, small things here and there, but nothing like the monumental changes that, for instance, Chloe Udaly, currently on the city council, was able to move around renters. We've got rent control light in Portland now, but it was because of this tenants' rights movement that put her into office, and it is still around, and showed up in City Hall over and over. And we just didn't have that sense of ourselves in the Rainbow Coalition. We had the rhetoric, but we didn't have the follow through. And then I think about as I drifted away from, or as the Rainbow Coalition sort of collapsed and into the new party, which became the Working Families Party and became much more connected with the Democratic Party establishment, I ended up doing electoral work for my union, Letter Carriers Union. I actually was taken off, I was paid by the union to take months off the job to work on candidate campaigns that were our priority for our national union, which in this case were, federal, because we were federal workers. So I ended up working on John Kerry's presidential campaign in 2004 and Jeff Merkley's Senate campaign in 2008. And I was really good at it, because I, knew about door knocking and phone banking. And what we actually did as letter carriers, and again, I'm being paid like to do this, right, often all day, every day for a couple months for the election. Our letter carriers, we would, because there wasn't, we didn't have all the kind of electronic mapping stuff that people have now, we would actually look at maps and draw walking routes for canvassers, because as letter carriers, we knew how to, how to park and loop neighborhoods. That was kind of fun. We had a number of us letter carriers were taking off work to do this. But when I think about the Kerry campaign, looking at it now, it was like, what? I had been part of the year before, 2003, this huge anti-war movement, when Bush invaded Iraq, and we had labor unions getting on board with this anti-war movement. Kerry was like, the lesser evil. I mean, he didn't even have an anti-war platform. Maybe it was like a little bit or something, and the same thing was true of Obama in 2008. Like his whole candidacy, which I worked on along with Merkley, he was supposed to be the peace candidate, and then of course he did the big surge into Afghanistan after he was elected. Of course, he probably said he was going to do that anyway, but I just think about that, those experiences as, I developed a lot of relationships with other labor activists that were, the AFL-CIO puts a lot of time and energy into candidate campaigns and meeting those people. But it was by the time I had retired, which is 2011, I went through a big change in my attitude toward politics in general. And I, because of the Occupy movement, and I got my hope back, and I had all this time on my hands, and Lauren and I had just broken up. And so I got involved with the International Socialists, which their attitude was like, fuck the Democrats, support independent candidates. They had supported Ralph Nader for president. And the point of running, of supporting candidates, was to get the message out, not to win, and the protest vote and all that. And we didn't even support Bernie Sanders in the first round, 2016. We said support Jill Stein, and but now I moved to a place where I just seen what happened with the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, where the socialist movement just ballooned by 10 times because of his campaign. Understanding just the, but also seeing, more clearly when you can elect people like Joanne Hardesty or Chloe Daly, that have this class struggle orientation and this decades of experience, certainly like Bernie Sanders has, that you can actually really move policy and make change. So my whole attitude about elections is different. I've been through a lot of, and then of course, most recently, I've always known that Oregon's ballot measure, our ability to do ballot measures, not just on the state, but on the county and the city level, have been really the most movement building kinds of electoral work, because you're there's no question about personalities or baggage or whatever. It's just the issue. And what we did with the latest DSA backed ballot measure, which is the tax the rich for universal preschool, is you know, we started with Tax the Rich, and because like that's the project that we haven't been able to accomplish. And then try to find the social service program that was, that really spoke to a, you know, a widely felt and deeply felt need in the community. And, you know, just, you know, knowing all these people that spend as much on preschool as they do for rent, that would be wildly popular. And of course it's going to win. And what we're doing with our membership and with the, you know, people that are close to us is saying, okay, look, this is actually possible. This is going to make a big difference in working class people's lives. And what's next? You know, what else can we, how, what else do we need that we can tax the rich and go after? And anyway, ballot initiatives are great.
Go back and just, I'm going to go back just a little bit.
You want to ask something? Go ahead.
Just that you mentioned a couple of things. One, the Occupy movement, which I know that we'll get to when we get to that place chronologically, but just that because it was such a big part of what you're saying, your shift in consciousness about or thinking about
politics.
It might be helpful just to give a small little summary of what that is.
What the Occupy movement is or what the
was.
Okay. Well, it was a culmination of the kind of desperation that young people who were coming out of college or dropping out of college and having huge debt and not much prospects for decent jobs coming out of the recession of 2008 and just starting by the occupation of a square and calling itself Occupy Wall Street. We are the 99%, they are the 1%. Defining this class struggle again in a way that hadn't, you know, just captured the popular consciousness of young people and just spread like wildfire. And there was an occupation that was set up in Chapman and Lonsdale Squares across from City Hall and the county courthouse in Portland that lasted about a month and a half, I think, before it was swept by the police. But the encampment was attracted a bunch of young people who wanted to create a new society inside this little encampment. But because, and it didn't have any particular, you know, demands except, you know, this is what democracy looks like and another world is possible. But the definition of, you know, we are the many, they are the few, we know who the enemy is, attracted a lot of, well, certainly those of us who had held that view, but were kind of not feeling very confident about it at the time. And even attracted a lot of support from the labor movement in terms of, you know, resources. And we actually had there was a march which with 10,000 people through Portland that ended up with the occupation being established in, and that march was really supported by the labor unions. They didn't participate in the actual setting up of the encampments, but we established a labor and Occupy Portland labor solidarity committee and campaign, and we were, you know, anyway, that whole experience of interacting with those young people and seeing a responsiveness among the young people in my union and among the young people that I was working with just gave me a lot more hope, I guess, about, you know, revolutionary potential, I suppose, I should say. And the people that I met who were in the International Socialist Organization were in the leadership, you know, of this Occupy Portland thing. So that was attractive to me. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. So going back a few years, where we left off, fall of 1999, I'm looking at a copy of the Rainbow News, which basically shows the transition from the Rainbow Coalition to joining the new party and describing the new party as signing up individual and organizational members, affiliating with community-based organizations such as ACORN, which people may or may not be familiar with, which lasted a few decades. Citizen Action, ACORN, we talked about already. Am I right?
Yes.
Yes. Local labor unions such as HERE, which is the hotel and restaurant workers, and SEIU, which is janitors, hospital workers, public employees. And in Portland, the steering committee of the new party was made up of activists from organizations such as the Coalition of Black Men, Oregon Action, which now is Unite Oregon, SEIU, HERE, PCC Faculty Federation, and Classified Employees. So interesting. Those people are still radical. Michael Dembro was the president of the PCC Faculty Federation at the time, and he's currently now a legislator and a leader in issues like, you know, Medicare for All and living wages and stuff. Michael Dembro. Go back a few decades. Environmental Justice Action, Brother to Brother, which was a gay men's, a black gay men's group, and Jobs with Justice. And what I found interesting in here with this issue was that there are two living wage ballot initiatives that are, this is fall of 1999, that it says the new party is launching Living Wages Act and the Workplace Stability Act in concert with labor and community allies and the Jobs with Justice Coalition, that basically, you know, takes a hold, it basically is targeted to the hundreds of agencies, nonprofit human service agencies that are funded by Multnomah County, from homes for the mentally retarded. What do we call, that we used to call the mentally retarded now? What is the appropriate language? I don't even remember now. Abused children, homeless shelters, drug treatment centers, and basically mandating that those workers be paid living wages and benefits and whatever. And then the Living Wages Act. Oh, that is the Living Wage Act. A Workplace Stability Act would, attack the problem of high turnover, low worker morale, low quality care, agency instability by helping workers gain an effective and collective voice on the job. Oh, so lowers barriers, workers' rights to organize and sustain a labor union. So it said, as of this writing, the language of the twin ballot initiatives has not been completed. 12,000 signatures needed to get it on the ballot. November 2000. I don't remember what happened, but it didn't happen. This did not happen.
What?
We did not put it on the ballot. We did not collect signatures. And I don't know. No, I don't remember why. I'm probably blocking it out.
That was 1999. When in
1999? Fall of 1999.
So somewhere in that year, something happened within the next year, and it never got on the ballot.
Right. And the only thing that I'm thinking about, I'm looking at this little ad for Resist the World Trade Organization, come to Seattle. Oh, great.
That was a...
The Battle of Seattle, which I participated in.
Yes.
I'll tell you the story, which was very exciting. Because we, you know, had been part of the movement, you know, for at least a decade by that time, against so-called free trade, which basically accelerated the outsourcing of the runaway shops to third world low-wage labor havens in primarily Asia, but also Mexico. And the, you know, of course, NAFTA and the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994 was the free trade agreement that opened up the runaway, accelerated runaway shops to Mexico. And the WTO was an attempt to make that happen throughout the world. And they were holding a conference, I don't know what it was called, convention, convergence, conference, whatever, of WTO countries from all over the world in Seattle in late November, early December. And we organized both the mainstream labor movement and the, which was like, you know, a big rally in the stadium and a march through Seattle. But also I was part of helping to organize the civil disobedience, the blockades, which effectively prevented the conference from happening by shutting down downtown Seattle. And we had people from the Jobs with Justice Coalition that were involved in both. But what was most amazing about that whole experience for me was that we rented or whatever, train cars. We had a number of train cars that went up to Seattle with labor unionists, AFL-CIO. And so it was like we had hours and hours, you know, of just like all these people together in these train cars going from seat to seat and talking and about all these, you know, about changing the world. And we really had this sense of when we got to Seattle of all these international delegations from all over the world showing up. And the environmentalists and the labor unions aligned against this free trade because of the free trade agreements also were horribly damaging to environmental regulations that basically allowed the undercutting of local environmental laws. And the theme was Teamsters and Turtles together at last. And I remember just being in this march where there were these like huge you know, puppets that the environmental groups used to use, and then all these, you know, union types in hard hats and stuff. And what was really exciting for me was that letter carriers showed up from all over, and a bunch of people from my union, and we had a contingent. And then all of that really got undercut and blown apart by the 9/11 attack in 2001, a couple of years later.
So the battle for Seattle was in 99?
Yes.
And what were the tactics? You were talking about the civil disobedience tactics that basically shut it down.
Yeah, what people did was they, I think this might've been the first time that I was aware of this particular tactic, which is that people sit down, but not just linking arms, but actually chaining themselves. Well, no, they use the what do they call them? These sleeves that where you put your, where you like almost handcuff yourselves to the next person. And then there's a sleeve over the, I don't know how it gets set up. I've never done it. I almost did it once, where it's like they can't pull you apart. The cops can't pull you apart, and you put yourself in front of whatever. You know, they blockaded the entrances to the convention center and blocked all kinds of intersections and stuff like that. But there were, of course, also the usual, you know, people who smashed windows at Starbucks and, you know, that kind of stuff. But that, yeah.
Things that are tangentially related, but not sanctioned by
the organized groups, or at least the visibly organized groups.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that was like a weekend?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I think it was more like a Monday, and the convention or whatever it was called was supposed to be all that week, and we basically I think the big labor march was only one day, but there continued to be, you know, these blockades and civil disobedience actions in the streets for days that basically kept the delegates from either leaving their hotels or getting into the convention center. And there were attempts to do that in subsequent years at different gatherings of the WTO to lesser or greater degrees of success, but that was like the big one, the battle in Seattle, that really kind of gave us a sense of what the potential was for that coalition. Unfortunately, like I said, it got blown apart by the war on terror after the 9/11.
The movement against free trade, the organized movement against.
What was called the movement against globalization, or globalization. The movement against free trade. Really undercut by the nationalist, you know, America first kind of mentality that came out of the war on terror that the Bush administration initiated after the attacks on the World Trade Center in September of 9/11. And it just, like, you know, this whole sense of international solidarity was really broken up. Took us a while to get it back. And, you know, I'm not sure we're there, but.
Well, does it make sense for us to talk about 9/11 right now? The Rainbow News that you were just reading was from 99.
Yeah. Yeah. But
we could go forward, or we can stick with the Rainbow News too, if you want to keep moving along with the news.
Yeah, let's finish up the Rainbow News. We're almost done with this. I just wanted to mention that there was a police accountability ballot initiative filed, but I don't remember voting on it. So I don't know, but it's like almost the same, exactly the same as the one that we're voting on right now in 2020. 20 years later, and certainly, you know, Joanne Hardesty, then Joanne Bowman, was in the center of the effort, but, you know, it would establish a citizen review board, which would have the final say in cases of police misconduct, independent investigatory power, right to subpoena. Are we all right?
Yeah, my phone just started talking to me.
Ability to review police shootings and deaths in custody. Hold public hearings on police policies. So, you know, police killing of Black people was of concern then, as it is now. Not new.
But that ballot measure never...
This ballot initiative, it says... persistent problems of racial profiling by police. Well, that's interesting. It doesn't say killings. I guess there'd only been a few high profiling killings at that point. There was a whole slew of them in the early 2000s. Shortage of bilingual officers and officers of color. And then there's this whole issue, which is on in this Rainbow News and the next one, I think, or maybe this is following up from an earlier one. On the MAX, the establishment of what's now the Yellow Line up the interstate corridor, where we were trying to intervene to prevent displacement of low-income people and people of color, to insist on affordable housing, living wage jobs for the current residents and business opportunities, renters' rights, community land trust, require the 25% of the tax increment financing go to fund community land trust acquisitions. Are you familiar with community land trust?
No.
That is, so it's basically that the land is owned publicly, but the homes are owned privately, so that the actual costs for to buy a home that's in a part of a community land trust is, you know, like half of what when you're buying both the land and the building. And so it makes it much more possible for low income people to caters to low income people getting home ownership. And there's the community land trust project is certainly exists, and it's called Proud Ground currently. Interestingly, it's being run by Diane Lynn, who is a former chair, Multnomah County chair, who was, part of our movement, who I met for the first time in 1969, when she was, her family, the Lynn family, which was an activist family, which was just a block away, their house was a block away from the Cadenza house, which was a commune I was part of. Anyway, Diane Lynn runs Proud Ground, which is the community land trust project now, but they only have the capital to purchase so much land, not much, and the kind of affordable housing problems that we have are so overwhelming compared to what they're able to accomplish. But it's a step back from public housing, where the everything is owned by the public, and then the occupants are renters, to home ownership that's public private. And then all these demands that we were making about this new urban renewal. We tried to be part of all the, advisory committees and all this stuff, but, it got away from us, and we didn't really get most of this. I mean, there's certainly a lot of people were displaced, a lot of low-income people of color were displaced with the, in the MAX line going in, and
the urban renewal efforts of this time. We're talking about urban renewal as sort of euphemistic term to describe what many people would call gentrifying the north of East Portland.
And I thought it was in this, maybe it was in an earlier issue where it talks about, that was, I didn't mention in the issue prior, it says IMAX, urban renewal or urban removal. And, it's basically agitating about the rights of the people that are there that end up getting displaced to the numbers. Right? And this was happening, it started happening in the early 2000s. Oh, and this is, I'm sorry, this is the spring of 2000 with this article. And, we had this People's Urban Renewal Campaign to push the Portland Development Commission, TriMet, City Council to do the right thing. Several new party members were on the Interstate Corridor Citizens Advisory Committee and active in the struggle through organizations such as the Coalition for a Livable Future, Urban League, Community Alliance of Tenants, Community Development Network, Environmental Justice Action Group, Brownfields Showcase, and the NAACP. Okay. And this mentions also that we hired an organizer, the new party hired an organizer, and I was the supervisor of that organizer. Oh, God. I was a supervisor for three different new party organizers over a period of, it wasn't long, it's probably just a year. Why did I hate being a supervisor? I told you about that before, right?
Well, remind me what you're meaning.
This model of organizing, where the organizer is basically knocking on doors and finding out what the issues of that are widely and deeply felt in the neighborhood, and trying to bring together neighborhood meetings to launch campaigns. The organizer is also signing up people as members of the organization, which then funds their salary, right? And so they have to produce a certain number of memberships to pay for their salary. And so there's this productivity, this quota system, which so many different, you know, whether it's what are the ones that come to the door? Greenpeace, that are on this model. And of course, I had to crack the whip. I was the supervisor, right? Hated it.
Yeah.
Being in that situation. And I remember my worst nightmare come true was when by that time I moved into Northeast Portland in 1998, and, you know, lived in this house on 7th Avenue across from the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods, which was on my mail route. And so we had the office of the new party was in my house. And so the organizer would come, you know, into my house, get set up, ready to go for the day, go out on the street, come back and report. And I think I probably had interactions also while I was delivering the people's mail with the organizer. But in any case, we had one, or the third organizer that we had, they were all Black women, young, she was really young, and she just didn't show up for days. And I'm like, not answering the phone. So I have to go over to her house, knock on her door, kind of roust her. Hate doing this. And it just reminded me of what happened to me when I first got fired from the Postal Service, which was a supervisor came to my house and knocked on my door. I had called in sick.
Yes,
I remember. To see if I was really sick. Anyway, never a supervisor again. I've been the leader of lots of campaigns, but when you're talking about getting, you have a quota for raising money and, paying people and all that stuff, it's just really different. And this next issue is the fall of 2000, this is all about schools again, and this particular issue is talking about stopping neighborhood school closures, where again they were, this was as the neighborhood was gentrifying, it really took off in the 90s. I probably said that my route was 80% Black when I first started in 1990, and by the time the 90s were over, it was almost down to like 30% Black, just within that 10-year period. And So what was happening was that the neighborhood schools, the people that were moving into the neighborhood were young white people, couples often, which they didn't have children. And the neighborhood schools so were shrinking in enrollment. And so they, of course, the schools that were slated for closure by the school district were the, you know, majority Black schools. And so we, the New Party Rainbow Coalition folks had launched this Stop School Closure, Stop Neighborhood School Closure campaigns. And our demand was fill them up, don't shut them down. I'm looking at this, well, you can't see it, but it's a photo of a demonstration, a protest at a school board where we're holding signs that say, school closures cause attendance problems, school closures destroy communities, school closures destroy, cause transportation problems, fill them up, don't shut them down. And what we were talking about was having, you know, setting up a nonprofit social services in the schools, you know, if the enrollment is declining, we'll use, you know, unused space, but rent, set up health clinics, set up continuing education programs for parents. I don't know what kinds of things we were suggesting. Here we go. Lighted schoolhouses. And this has been introduced by one of our New Party Rainbow people on the board, Joseph Tam. The National Lighted Schoolhouses Movement shows us a way to save costs, improve academic achievement, share space, pay rent, as well as adult education, health, recreation, and other services. Okay.
And that was a ballot initiative, or was it?
No, it was trying to get it was trying to prevent these schools from getting closed, and we did. I'm not sure how we did it. Oh, no, we did lose Humboldt got closed, and eventually Harriet Tubman got closed as well.
And then Harriet Tubman reopened.
And there was another school closure fight. And this particular one did not have the teachers union behind us. And there was another school closure fight that happened 10 years later, maybe 10 years, maybe 12 or 13 years later, 2014 maybe. By that time the teachers union leadership had changed and had seen some examples from like the Chicago teachers union of uniting with communities of color against school closures, where the teachers, when we were fighting the closure of Vernon, Woodlawn, I can't remember where the Boise Elliott was on a chopping block, but these majority Black and Brown schools, the teachers union was on board. And so that, and we stopped those school closures. And then when the teachers union was ready to strike the next year, there was tremendous community support in the inner North Northeast, which is where I was the leader of the community organizing for that support for that strike, but we'll get to that later.
Speaking of that, Jimmy.
Yes. Oh, it's 4:00. How did that happen?
No, time flies when you're having fun.
Oh, yes. Okay.
That last issue that you were looking at is from 2000?
Fall of 2000. We didn't get very far, but we talked about some stuff that was not chronological, so that counts.
Which is great and necessary.
Something.
Yeah. All right, I'm gonna press stop record.